so,
won't
okay.
be any offices in here.
Well,
something I keep hearing saying that there's going to be 20 some offices left here.
The mics are live.
Okay. Good morning, everyone. The Senate E-12 Finance and E-12 Policy Committees will come to order, and thank you, Senator Ray. We have a very ambitious agenda with great talent before us. We've titled it Voices from the Classroom. We're going to hear from several teachers of the year in Minnesota. One of the testifiers wasn't actually a recipient of that designation, Superintendent Metz, but is here to offer related insight. But we have made a modification on the agenda, and you'll get the new agenda very soon. We will have very limited time for Q&A. We're going to do our best, and obviously most of these topics are going to be before us during the upcoming session as well. So we're going to start by taking people in order, and we have Derek Olson, the 2008 Minnesota Teacher of the Year, and we'll ask each of the testifiers if they could just please give maybe a 20-second bio of themselves for the committee, and then we'll proceed to the testimony on the point that's bulleted in the handout. So welcome. Please proceed.
Senator Wigger, thank you so much for having us here today. My name is Derek Olson. I teach sixth grade in the Stillwater area schools at Afton Lakeland Elementary. I've been there for 14 years, and before that I was in St. Louis Park for 10 years. So we have a good representation from St. Louis Park today with Mr. Metz and Leanne speaking later today. I was the 2008 Minnesota Teacher of the Year. And I have a special guest today with me that I'd like to point out. She's going to be embarrassed that I'm doing that. But over there, please wave, Kaya, is my daughter, who is a senior at Stillwater Area High School, and she's taking a government class. And one of those darn requirements is they have to go to some sort of government hearing. And we sort of, and her government teacher, thought this really fit the bill pretty well. My topic is indeed the implementation of the new teacher evaluation statute here in the state. And I'd like to approach my remarks from three different perspectives. First and most importantly, as a teacher in the trenches, currently participating in the rollout as a teacher of a new teacher evaluation plan out in Stillwater. Secondly, as a member of the committee in Stillwater that put together that plan. It was a joint committee of administrators, union representatives, and teachers who put together the plan to use as opposed to the state default plan, which is also available for districts to choose to use. And the third perspective I'll be talking about teacher evaluation from is that as a researcher. This past spring, I co-authored some research, which was a survey of hundreds of state teachers of the year from around the country. It was titled, and I have it right here, From Good to Great, Exemplary Teachers Share Perspectives on Increasing Teacher Effectiveness Across the Career Continuum, which ultimately, when we talk about teacher evaluation, is what we're trying to do, increase teacher effectiveness. The executive summary of this survey should be in your packet of handouts, which has in it links to the entire findings if you'd like to look at them at some point on your own. And if not, I won't be offended. It's research. Also, I'm currently working on the data analysis phase of my own dissertation. The topic of that one is also a survey of teachers of the year from all across the country from the last 6 years, asking them for their perspectives on the characteristics of teacher quality as reflected in Charlotte Danielson's framework for teaching. And this is important because the framework for teaching is the observation tool that is that the observations are based on in the state default model for teacher evaluation. So with that background, that's sort of where I'm coming from, those three different angles. The most important thing I think is for you to know regarding teachers and teacher evaluation is that, contrary to common opinion, teachers are not afraid of teacher evaluation. There was a poll 2 years ago of all teachers in the state, and the majority of teachers actually welcome a teacher evaluation plan as long as it's fair, accurate, and has a dual focus of development, not just evaluation, and that it be based on student growth and not student intelligence. That being said, I have to admit, I am a bit concerned. We are rolling this out right now, and it's very clear to see that right now this statute on teacher evaluation appears to be very underfunded, and I won't say unfunded, but at least underfunded, and I hope you'll consider, as the Finance Committee, changing that. And I just want to give you a couple of reasons why I think for this plan to accomplish what you would like to see it accomplish, it takes some resources. Recently, in one of the largest studies, educational studies conducted, the measures of effective teaching, one of the key findings was that there's only a correlation between the evaluative observations of trained administrators and teacher quality as reflected in student growth if and only if the administrators have had a significant amount of training in the tool that they're using to evaluate the teachers with, and if and only with the teachers being trained have a significant amount of training and understanding of the tool that's being used to observe them. Well, unfortunately, as a new system is being rolled out in tight budgetary times, we do have administrators that will tell you if they were here that no, they do not feel like they've had the extensive amount of training necessary to very accurately use the tools that they're being asked to use to evaluate their teachers, and that teachers don't necessarily understand these new tools that they need to be working towards being evaluated by. And for the goals of the teacher evaluation program to really work towards improving all teachers, I think we really, really need to figure out a way to find the time and the resources to fund that training. The second facet of a teacher evaluation plan that I think is really, really important, and this is a little bit better news as far as what some research has shown and what's happening in our classrooms, it regards peer evaluations. As part of the statute, there's a component where teachers need to start getting more into each other's rooms and observing each other and providing feedback to each other. Well, again, one of the neat findings that we found in this that was not something that had been found in any other research really applies to this, and I think will give you some pause for hope, I think, in this regard. But let me backtrack and say that I hope we all agree that when we talk about an effective teacher evaluation plan, our goal is to ensure that every student has a great teacher in front of them. So that's not just about having a minimum bar that we get all teachers to barely meet, but we want to move the entire bell curve of teachers from being good to great or from novice to good to great. We want to move everyone, all of us want to be better teachers. Well, it's not surprising when award-winning teachers were asked, what helped you get from being novice to good? A couple of the things that were frequently said were things like having a great mentor, having an instructional coach, having a really supportive principal. Those things aren't surprising. Other research has said that's common sense. But what was really interesting and what was one of the key findings was when asked what helped teachers get from good to great, what helped them move from being in the middle of their career to being a phenomenal teacher, they said over and over and over again that it was providing those very supports that were helpful to them on the receiving end when they were younger. So in other words, having a mentor helps teachers go from being novice to good. Being a mentor, according to exemplary teachers, is one of those things that helped them go from being good to very, very great. And I think this is really important for you to hear, because as you're dealing with how do we spend money and limited resources, well, anytime you can find that synergy of efficiency where you can get a double bang for the buck, it's awesome. And so when you put money into something that supports mentorship and teachers being able to collaborate, it's not just helping the mentee, it's helping the mentor, and it's developing strong teacher leaders in this state, and that's what we really, really, really need. Finally, I'd like to make a simple point about teacher evaluation in general that I hope you all keep in mind. One of the things that many of us get concerned about when scores are used, it's not that we tend to be afraid of the scores of our students being used to judge us, but oftentimes we use scores that test student intelligence and ability, not what they've learned. And there are tests that focus on growth. And I think that's such a more, when we're looking at evaluating teachers, I would think you wouldn't necessarily want to know how smart my students are, but how have I brought them, regardless of where they came into my room, in the fall? How have I brought them from here to here? Not where did they end up, but if I have three children of my own. One of them's here with me today, as I pointed out. They're all at very different ability levels in different subjects. I want to know that the teachers they have will take them where they are and grow them forward. And there are tests out there that do that, like the and I hope that we will consider really looking at growth tests as we look at teacher evaluation. Finally, there are many more things I could say on the topic of implementation of the new teacher evaluation statute, but we have great STOI colleagues here with me, and they have other very important topics to discuss. So I'd just like to point out again that if you're interested in this research on moving teachers towards effectiveness, you have a link to it in the handout you have. I'd be happy to answer any questions from my perspective on teacher evaluation, on the implementation of this program right now. Also in the future, feel free if you ever do want to hear from a teacher in the trenches as this issue comes up. Any of you can always feel free to reach out to me. I'd be happy to give you my time. And again, thank you for being here today and for obviously your concern in providing a great teacher in front of every student in the state of Minnesota. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. We definitely will be following up on reviewing the report and subsequent hearings. We're going to take initially a couple of questions, and that'll be from Senator Bonhoff, and we'll have two. Senator Bonhoff first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Olson, for being here today. Congratulations on your great work with our students. We appreciate it. So you talked about the underfunding of the teacher eval, and my question to you is, and it's a comment that I'd like then you to comment on.
Sure.
It occurs to me that if you're a QComp district, and many of our districts are, that you get a significant amount of money towards teacher development. And so my approach to this whole challenge of funding the teacher eval was that the QComp districts could, in fact, align their QComp programs and funding with the teacher eval law. So the real problem, it looked to me, were the third of districts that weren't funded with QComp dollars. I'm wondering if you could comment on that approach, if in fact we assumed you could align the QComp dollars with the teacher eval and just pick up the hole, so to speak, the donut hole, with those school districts that weren't QComp funded.
I'll do my best. Again, my expertise is in my classroom, and I'm very familiar with the research that's out there on teacher evaluation. I am not as confident in talking about the QComp policy, but I will tell you that I also work in a district that is one of the third districts that does not have QComp, so
gotcha.
I'm not as just familiar with it on a daily basis. But I can tell you that districts that are using QComp as it's intended to be used, and this then, and I'm it's really speaking off the top here, probably in deeper water than I should be speaking. There's probably some really good ways to be using that money, and then asking for this intense additional piece of evaluation of teachers is sort of a separate piece. It's even for those districts that are using QComp money. I would think that it's still an additional burden on a tight district on how to really effectively roll out a program where you want to have your administrators highly trained in what they're, in the old days, if teacher evaluation isn't really being, if it's not very high stakes, if a teacher is evaluated poorly, and it just goes in a file, I guess it didn't really matter, but it's starting to really matter how an administrator evaluates a teacher. And so with that in mind, we need to make sure that those are fair and accurate evaluations. And I believe that the principals I've talked to would be the first to say that takes some serious training and some serious work.
Good.
I don't feel like I answered your question very well.
No, it helped to understand you aren't in a QComp district, so it's probably difficult. But so I can see especially why you'd feel the crunch of the no funding. Thank you.
Thanks. And the Department of Education, there's a task force working on development of recommendations exactly on point. And, again, this will be revisited. Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Mr. Olson, for your testimony. Very thoughtful, and we know that, especially when it comes to teacher evaluation, really the only buy-in that we're going to get, or the only way we're going to get buy-in from teachers, is if it is meaningfully connected to improving teaching and learning in the classroom. And so just great stuff there. But when it comes to that, and you touched on some of them, when it comes to teacher training and professional development, right now, what would you say we're doing right, and what are the things that we need to improve on? And I got your notes on peer evaluations and the importance of mentoring. If you could just frame that up for us, what are we doing right, and what do we need to do better when it comes to training and PD?
That's Senator Peterson, that's a really great question. The challenge in answering it, I think, is that what we're doing right and what we're doing wrong varies. The answer to that is probably lies in as many, not only districts, but as many schools as we have in this great state. So even within my district, we were talking, for instance, about how professional learning communities, which will be touched on later, are very, very different in our districts. In my district, the way those are dealt with are very, very different from building to building. So it's a very tough question to answer. But I think that globally speaking, I think we're doing it right when we keep the focus on developing teachers to be better and not on grading teachers. And we're doing teacher evaluation wrong when we're investing a lot of money in grading teachers and not in making teachers wherever they are better. I firmly believe we want to get a great teacher in front of every single child. And that means no matter how good we are, we can grow to get better. So we are doing a good job when we are providing opportunities not just to remediate teachers that need help, but who have been identified as struggling, but when we're also providing the resources that teachers need to get better. And I can tell you what I need more than anything else to get better, personally, and I'm only speaking for myself, I need time. As far as the mandate for observing another teacher, I teach science and social studies in a sixth grade building. I want to be able to go observe someone teaching the same subject, sixth grade, in a different building, but that takes time and resources. And then we can collaborate and talk and see what's working. In many ways, teaching can be a very isolated profession, and especially for those of us who teach in districts where there's many schools still where there's only one teacher per grade level in a school. Those people are very, very isolated. They have very little time for collaboration. And so that's one of the things I think we really, really need. Have I touched on your question a little there?
Yeah, you okay. Did. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Wilson.
My pleasure. And thank you again for having us and for all your time.
Okay. Thanks. Jackie Roll, 2012 Teacher of the Year.
Good morning, all of you. I'm Jackie Rail from Edina High School. I teach 10th and 12th grade English there. And I actually have just modified my remarks because I want to speak to Senator Peterson's question, and I want to answer it because it's a sub-bullet point of the statute on teacher evaluation, is that schools should be encouraged to have professional learning communities. And I think that idea is misunderstood. We talked about it in our meeting before, about how it is implemented differently in every school in my district. It's implemented differently in all the districts around the state. And it really is a valuable staff development tool. And so I want to explain what it looks like and what it is. And so I don't really need to ask for more staff development funding, my second bullet. What I need to ask for instead is flexibility in the school day. And in the high school has 1,020 hours it has to meet, and that is what's constraining our growth more than the funding that we need. And so I told my colleagues I wasn't going to ask for money. I was going to ask for just flexible understanding on how we build our school day to accommodate professional learning communities. So when I talk about professional learning communities to people who are not educators, they think it's something that the teachers are trying to pull over on the state, that, oh, you want more time to just be together with your adult colleagues. And it's not just that. It is such a valuable professional growth that I actually probably would have left the teaching profession 5 years ago had our school district not formed professional learning communities, because it is isolating. You are in your classroom. You never really get a chance to talk to an adult except in a brief, you know, 5-minute conversation over lunch perhaps, and you can't really grow a school, you can't grow the climate, and you can't really impact the teaching that you're doing in the classroom with students in that short period of time. And so we started professional learning communities kind of like on a voluntary basis, on, you know, meet before school or after school. And too often that was coaching responsibilities, childcare responsibilities, got in the way of everyone on the team being there to talk about your curriculum, to talk about the data that was coming in on your students. And so Edina High School built it into the school day. And we built in just a collaborative Wednesday where we could have students working half of their, we extended the lunchtime, and we could have half of the students meet with teachers on special remediation or some enrichment opportunities. And then the next half hour, the teachers got to meet together and the students would be with the other teachers that they happen to be with. That only works at a high school level. So the other schools in my district are kind of upset about that because they can't give a first grader an hour and 15 minutes for lunch and hope that they go work with another teacher. And so we have a real crossroads of needing time to do this work. And so let me tell you what the research that really Richard DeFore is the leader in professional learning communities. And he has said there are three things that you should do at a team meeting. And so we focus on those team meetings. And those are, what is it we want our students to learn? How will we know when each student has learned it? And how can we improve on current levels of student achievement? And those are key questions that, as a novice teacher, I wasn't asking myself that. I was just kind of planning, what would my lesson plan look like? Not stepping back and looking at the big picture of what are the standards, what are the goals? And so in a professional learning community, my team develops common assessments. And so we think about what is the actual state standard we're trying to meet? How can we assess it? How will we know when our students have met that? And that collaboration and talking does not require money. It just requires time to allow that in the school day for teachers to do that. And then the question of how will we know when each student has learned it really focuses on equity in my PLC. When it's each student, we specifically, as a team, we own all of the students. And my PLC is for the sophomore English students at Edina High School. We have a huge PLC. We have 11 teachers because we have a detract English class, so every sophomore takes it. So we have 650 sophomores, but there are students we all know already that we talk about, that it's even that student is in another teacher's class, that what are we going to do to reach this student so that this student is not dropping out, that this student is not failing and going to our alternative high school, or if this student is really, even talk about the highest end students. There was a student who wrote an incredible paper who said, oh, how are we going to enrich that student and challenge that student because she is at a different level? And so we own them all together, and our enrichment and our growth, Senator Peterson, is just from that. We don't need the money. That's what's really working well. But other schools don't have that luxury, or they're not have not implemented that yet. And the other thing, back to the time, and again, people do say, why do you need it in your contract day? Richard DeFore, the leader in professional learning communities, has done research and said if it's not in the day, too often people don't see it as a priority. They don't see that their district or that their state is committed to teachers working together for students. And so it sends a strong message in it that this is a priority. And it also, it just is just a way that you can't get out of it, which is what I was finding 5 years ago. A team member would say, I have to pick up my child. I can't meet this meeting. And so it's in the day. But in other elementary and middle schools, they would have to have late starts or early releases, which some districts do. And that is very unpopular in communities. And it's very hard to navigate in our school because we to get 25 minutes, and we only built in 25 minutes, which if you think about a business getting only 25 minutes a week to meet, to talk to colleagues, you would think that was not even remotely close to what you needed in a business situation. But we like value that we were given 25 minutes. But to do that, we had to start 5 minutes early every day. And then we had transportation issues around the district. So just to build in that time, we had to start, because we literally were counting our minutes to get to our 1,020 hours at the high school. And if we could build in, and I've been trying this for years, to just one late start a week so that teachers could have a full hour that was valued for teacher prep. We were also talking about in Finland in our meeting before how we teach twice as many hours in a year than the Finnish teachers teach because they value teacher collaboration. And when the students are in front of you, making that time more valuable because you know what you're doing. And so you're not going to suffer instruction. You're just not going to have wasted time when you have the teacher in front of you. And so I want to just kind of talk about that is kind of my call to action, is to just allow schools the flexibility as we move into 2015, 2016, and students are looking at education. We're going to have people talk about technology later and flipping classrooms and blended learning, that counting minutes in the next decade might not be where we want to be going in education, to provide flexibility for students and teachers to work together one-on-one and for having teachers be able to work together. And that's what professional learning communities can give us. So I just want to thank you for your time to listen to my specific thing of what's kind of working in schools and that we have to start expanding it more.
Thank you, Ms. Rail. Questions? Senator Johnson.
Mr. Chair when you talked about time, it really struck me because I am on kind of a road of looking at non-academic barriers to learning. And this is one that I will include with the others that I have on been provided to me and figured out some myself maybe. But time is really an important thing, and if we could get that sort of thing realized, I think we would have a great benefit for the students in our classrooms. And I wondered if you think of it as a non-academic barrier.
Ms. Ryan. I think that the time in my high school is changing. What a classroom looks like. We're a bring-your-own-device school, and so there are times when I am sitting in my classroom where if I had 45 minutes in the day versus a 55-minute class period, I could still accomplish what I needed. And so time is a barrier because not every student, whoever sat down, I think it was when they developed the Carnegie unit in like 1900 and somebody decided it was the presidents of Princeton, Yale, Harvard, and Stanford got together and decided on this is what the school day should look like. And a school day should be in the secondary system for one. You should be like 1 hour for a class period. And the reason, if people knew that was the impetus for making our school day like it was, and it was just so that they could decide who should get into their institutions. And so it was because of that reason that we just have such a slow way to change. And school and education is changing. And sitting there 55 minutes is tough for a student, where they probably would be fine with a half an hour and then a half an hour of independent work where the teacher would have this flexibility. And so in our collaborative time, when the students have their time, they come and work with me one-on-one. If they could have that every day, because they just... Now the students at Edina High School want it almost every day. They're like, I have to wait till next Wednesday to come and talk to you for, you know, about this paper. And so if the day had something built in every day that was a time where teachers could meet every day and students could meet one-on-one with teachers every day, and the students would still get the amount of instruction because so much of our instruction now is online and is in that flipped or blended environment, at least at the high school level. So
thank you.
One more question at this point. Senator Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Rial, I've heard, not just from you, but from the other testifier, that evaluating teachers is not the best way to go at increasing education. I'm concerned we're not getting always the best teachers out there. And so to me, there's got to be some way of testing that. Mm-hmm. And my concern is not necessarily in your schools. My concern is in Minneapolis, where, you know, we're graduating about 50%. The other aren't graduating on time. That's unbelievable. And so we're missing something. Do you have any thoughts on what we're missing in Minneapolis? I understand it's not your district.
Well,
but what would you change?
I'm going to go back to, I really think it's teachers need collaboration with each other. It's not been anything that was in the teaching profession. It was always set up as you go in, you shut your door, and you teach your students. And I think that if Minneapolis could have some collaboration, I know that there is the Minneapolis teacher who's, there's 17 new teachers in her building this year, and so she needs to have time to collaborate with them. They might also need, in their professional learning communities, one of the other things that Richard DeFore says that professional learning communities need is outside, perhaps, consultants or education, because you can't say that you know everything, even though we have 11 teachers sitting in the room. And so the professional learning communities in the schools could bring in people who have worked in professional learning communities or bring in outside sources to work in their team, if they had the time to work together. The other thing that I will tell you is that even in my school, we have so many ways to grow as teachers. We really are not afraid of evaluation and growth. And we're really hard on each other in our professional learning community. And we kind of hold each other to higher standards because we're together. Where I think in the past, when you were isolated, you could hide as a teacher, and you're worried about poor teachers, that would be a way they couldn't hide because they are with other adults. You might be able to fake it with the students. But if they are held to a high standard with their peers, we really use a lot of kind of peer pressure at the adult level. And so those schools could benefit from that, and they might need some outside consultants because, like I said, in that one elementary school, there were 17 new teachers, and the teacher who was experienced was just frustrated with having to mentor all of the people as just an extra part of her duty day. And so if she could have formed a professional learning community, she could have brought some of those teachers along. The other thing about it is the teachers that are not great are not going to be able to hide, and so they're going to have to leave the profession because they won't be able to hide with their adult peers that are holding them accountable with looking at student data every week. And we say, how come you have that many Fs? We ask each other that. What did you do to remediate for that student that you just failed? And that's tough if you... So it would be a way to solve that problem, too.
Thank you.
Make the teachers accountable to each other.
Thank you, Ms. Rail. I believe Edina's school district's motto is or used to be, we care, we dare, we share, and we appreciate your doing that.
Thanks. Thank you very much, all of you.
Megan Hall, 2013 Minnesota Teacher of the Year.
Thank you, Senator Weaker. It's a pleasure to be here. I am a life science teacher in secondary education, both middle school and high school, at Open World Learning Community in St. Paul Public Schools. I have also taught at the Area Learning Center in St. Paul Public Schools. And I will be talking about dual enrollment options. So a little autobiography add-on is that I hold an IB diploma from Southwest High School in Minneapolis. The first thing I'd like to share today is that Minnesota is doing well in areas of dual credit enrollment. We're on the road. We're progressing in a positive way. You have several handouts from me. And the one page, there's three one-page documents, and they all indicate that participation by low-income students and students of color in Minnesota in our dual enrollment programs has grown significantly since 2007, and it has actually outstripped the overall rise in participation of all our Minnesota students. And to me, that's really positive news. I'd also like to make sure that we know that dual credit options are in four categories. One I mentioned already is International Baccalaureate, or IB programs, which offer college-level rigor in a high school setting in a very structured format. We also have Advanced Placement, which is more of an a la carte way of offering college rigor in a high school setting. We have College in the Schools, which is a collaboration between high school teachers and college professors to create a college course that is taught by a high school teacher in a high school setting. And then finally, post-secondary enrollment option, or PSEO, in which high school students attend college classes on college campuses. So three of the ways that we do dual enrollment in Minnesota is within the high school, and the fourth is on the college campus. For all four of those options, we see a correlation with high school graduation rates. We see students in dual enrollment also having higher levels of college enrollment and higher levels of college completion. It's an opportunity that we know helps students succeed. You also have a larger document for me. It's sort of a thick packet. It's a preliminary study. It's unpublished. It's from our own University of Minnesota. And there are quite a few compelling findings in that study, and it's long, so I'll summarize. We see that having accelerated coursework in high school leads to a higher college GPA and a faster graduation from college. We see that advanced placement, or AP, is the most effective in all of our options in terms of predicting first term and first year credit completion. And IB is the most effective in predicting GPA for the first term and first year of college. And also that PSEO students graduate from college faster than anyone else. But for me, the most important finding in the study is that students from households with low socioeconomic status who do get an opportunity to take advanced coursework do just as well in their first term and in their first year as students from high socioeconomic status households who do not take advanced courses. So in other words, the opportunity to take college-level rigor in the high school setting closes the achievement gap in the first year of college. To me, that's a pretty pretty significant finding. Interestingly, all these benefits, you know, higher graduation rate, higher GPA, higher college graduation enrollment, are the greatest for low-income students, low-achieving students, and male students, which are all demographics that we're concerned about. And what I want to speak about a little bit today is how oftentimes we think of a student as being an AP student or not an AP student, or a student as being sort of the classic good student who belongs in a dual enrollment course. And in my experience, and also now the research is showing, it's really all students that need to be heavily recruited into the dual enrollment classes. When I was a first-year teacher, and I was only 24 years old, and I was teaching in St. Paul's Area Learning Center, all my students were tagged as at risk for dropping out of high school. And I started the first AP class in the Area Learning Center in the history of Minnesota. And my students loved it. And I saw a jump. I saw students who may have been low-achieving in a traditional class respond to the promise and the rigor and the self-confidence of, now I'm going to try something harder. It's not magic. Like, I can't promise that every kid who has struggled in their whole life, if we just put them in a college in the schools class, that they'll start achieving. But there is a developmental window that opens around the age of 15 for perseverance and for grit and some of those non-cognitive factors. And it does appear that when students are recruited, particularly by a teacher with whom they have a positive relationship, into a rigorous class, that they are more likely to enroll in that class, stay in that class, and take it. And to this day, I have students who weren't speaking English until third or fourth grade because they came here as refugees from the mountains of Laos. I have students with learning disabilities. I have students who try to drop the class in the first couple weeks of school, and I encourage them to stay. Our school counselor encourages them to stay. They complete the AP class, they get into college, and then they come back 4 years later. We have students from our tiny little school, our little public magnet school in St. Paul, in Gustavus, St. Olaf, Carleton, U of M, who have all emerged from our AP program now, which is about 10 years old at Open World Learning Community. So I guess my ask from you is, and I'm no policymaker, so I don't know how you could do this, but that we find some way to encourage more students to take college-level courses when they're in high school. And right now, it's a lot of on-the-ground work. It's a lot of teachers who know a kid, tapping them on the shoulder or talking them in the hallway and say, I really think you need to take my AP class. And if there's any systemic way that we can encourage more students to look into their AP, IB, CIS, and PSEO options, that'd be great. I guess I would also add that, in my opinion, PSEO is doing fine. In Minnesota, I don't think we need to do very much to change our PSEO policy. There are some kids that really do benefit for getting on a college campus, but I think most students benefit from having the college-level rigor in a familiar setting with all the supports that high school has to offer. I have students that are ready to think at the higher level, but they need a teacher reminding them when their homework is due. They need someone looking over their shoulder, someone who can call their parents easily to touch base. So I think that that within the school options are areas to focus. I wanted to share one more story which is actually from a high school friend of mine, my best friend in high school. We both earned our IB diplomas side by side, and when she went to the University of Minnesota, she entered as a sophomore plus a quarter. So she had quite a few credits that she carried with her. And she didn't graduate early. She graduated on time. So even though this could have been a big money-saving opportunity for her, it actually bought her time to explore different majors. And she spent some time as a biology major. She's explored the social studies. Eventually, she earned an art degree and is a very successful graphic designer now. But having that that credit boost as she entered, it can be a money-saving help, but it can also be a time-buying boost. So I guess I would just add, we talk a lot about testing and about the value of tests. I took IB as a student, and I teach AP, and I've taught AP my whole career. My kids only get college credit for their year of coursework with me if they have a good day on testing day. They have to pass the AP or IB test, that exam, very high-stakes exam, to get their college credit. And I have just recently had some colleagues take on some college in the school classes, which, again, is that college-level rigor. But as long as the student passes the exams the teacher provides and does the work of the course, they will earn their college credit for college in the schools. And right now, I'm not sure if college in the schools is as well-known or has as much support as AP and IB, but from my experience, it is a very worthwhile thing to explore. And of course, we always have to talk about money, and all these courses are expensive. My school has benefited from grants from foundations to help pay for our teacher training. We wouldn't be able to buy our textbooks if we didn't have grant money paying for the college-level textbooks, which are, $150 a piece. It adds up, and it doesn't fit within our budgets. So I think you already know. I think there's already items in your budget to support AP and IB and college in the schools, and I thank you for that.
Thank you, Ms. Hall. Senator Klassen.
No.
And then Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Senator Wieger. Ms. Hall, thank you very much, especially those last comments about CIS, because that's of an interest area for me. I'm a former high school principal in the Rosemont-Apple Valley-Eagan district, and we were usually ranked second or third for the highest student enrollment in the CIS University of Minnesota program, and I also served on the board at the University of Minnesota for the CIS program. This fall, I'm visiting approximately 12 schools around the state who are currently offering the CIS program for students. I think you pointed out very well about we're measuring the student growth over a period of time in the CIS courses versus you need to pass that test. We also know that the AP scores, it fluctuates from college to college, university to university, whether they'll accept it. Whereas the CIS, if a student passes that course, they get a University of Minnesota transcript. One of the things that you pointed out is we do provide state funding for these programs. However, the CIS program is greatly underfunded when you compare to the others. And so this is something my colleagues, I'll be coming back to you. Senator Pratt and I will be at Shakopee High School on Friday. He's joining me, and we're going to be visiting there with their program. And so far, I've visited some charter schools, private school, public school, so we're getting a broad spectrum of responses from schools on the program. So I really appreciate your support of the program and what you're doing for our students here in Minnesota. So thank you.
Thank you, Senator Klassen. The feeling is very mutual. As the years go by, I know I grew up in IB and I heard about AP earlier, but CIS really has the best of all worlds. Mm-hmm. It has the input of a college-level professor. It has the relationship building of a high school teacher and the comfortable setting in the high school.
One of the things that we're really hearing from the teachers is the professional growth they have of interaction with a college professor. Mm-hmm. And that in the summer, as you know, they go to training at the university. The college professor comes out to their building, to their school, and visits and observes the teacher. And enough said. It's a great program. Thank you.
Okay, and I believe, Senator Klassen, you've distributed a schedule to colleagues interested in the tour?
Yes, I have. We've invited our colleagues both in the House and the Senate to join me as we visit the schools around the state. Thank you.
Senator Nelson.
Oh, thank you, Chair Wieger, and Ms. Hall, thank you so much for that testimony and your interest in dual enrollment, and particularly your clarion call that we encourage more of our high school students to enroll in dual enrollment classes and the great results that we see from that. So thank you so much for that. I have... And also for the information that you've provided, and I've just been perusing the U of M report here quickly, and I wondered if you could repeat for me, I think you were just kind of briefly giving the summary of this report, and I think you said PSEO kids graduate from, they get their college degrees in the shortest amount of time,
yes.
And you also said something about, I think, the AP kids, and I'm wondering if you can just kind of repeat those summaries for us.
Students who participate in AP have higher first-term and first-year credit completion in college. They're more likely to complete their coursework. Students in IB courses have higher GPAs, their first-term and first-year. And then all of the accelerated coursework, including CIS, leads to a higher college GPA and a faster graduation rate from college.
Great. Thank you. And maybe, Mr. Chair, one thing to just, I visited with the CIS, with the high schools in my district that offered CIS, and just this past week. And I know one of the things I hope we'll discuss or we'll look into is that funding mix, and to try and understand what that exact cost is, because I believe with the CIS students, the funding still follows the student for the K-12 funding. So that is there, and yet the state was putting in some CIS funding, but there still appears to be a gap. And my superintendents or principals, they weren't real clear on what the total funding mechanism is per student for CIS once we've included the K-12 funding as well. So maybe that's something we can delve into as we look at how we can better encourage more dual enrollment.
It's on the docket.
Thank you.
And in the interest of time, we'll take one. Senator Frentzen, and remember, we were about 10 minutes tardy as a group, so I'm going to try to get us back on schedule. But
thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Hall, for your testimony. I myself am an AP, graduate, if you will. I completed my AP courses in high school, and I ended up finishing college, undergrad, a year early with a little bit of summer and J-term. So I can attest to the value of the AP courses for myself for saving money and time. You mentioned, and my question is more in the lines of equity. You mentioned how can we encourage students to systemically take more AP and PSEO courses, et cetera. And you also talked in your testimony about the tag of having an at-risk child and how that kind of follows the kid throughout the system. I can see that as well in regards to what Senator Hall was talking about in Minneapolis. There is the other tag of you're an ELL child, and a lot of students never lose that tag, even though they've, met their standards and move forward in learning the proficiency of a second language, particularly our immigrant kids. So to the extent possible, how can we encourage legislatively? Do you have any creative ideas how we can, once you get a tag, it's hard to get rid of, and that can come from the administration, come from the system, it can come from a teacher. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to brush off, but we have a limited window for kids to be able to take these courses to move forward, and looks like and sounds like the research is there that the benefits are tremendous, particularly for populations of color and immigrants, and we have a lot of them in our system, and we have a growing number of them in Minneapolis schools and in our schools throughout our state. So we can't continue to ignore that, and this seems to be not the only solution, but one tool that we can use to move the needle in these populations. So do you have any ideas? I know you're asking us as policymakers, but how do we, as a teacher, how do you label kids in a certain way, whether purposefully or whether it's because you have to provide some services to them, that we can move that to leverage what we're doing with what you're talking about and remove that label and allow for more opportunities for these kids who can benefit the most?
One thing that the state government has already done is made sure that tests are free. There's a pretty significant fee for taking any given test, and the majority of students in my AP class this year are ELL students, and they could never afford the tests on their own. Mm-hmm. So making sure that the test is free is something we've already done that makes it more accessible to everyone. I don't know that we need to lose the labels, because sometimes labels can be informative to teachers. For me to know, the majority of my class speaks multiple languages, and English wasn't maybe the first language, and maybe I need to be really explicit about the sophisticated vocabulary that comes with an AP science course. But I think it's a mindset shift that we need to make, this idea that AP is for everyone, IB is for everyone, CIS is for everyone, that I think, now I've only heard a few anecdotes, but I think CIS might actually be better at than some of the other programs, because there is some flexibility in designing the coursework. So there could be a CIS course that, for example, we hear a lot about students taking remedial courses. Once they get into college, they have to take all these remedial courses, and it's very expensive. Well, you can create a CIS remedial course, and actually it's been done, where students take care of that remediation before they get to college. So you can design a CIS course to address labels, which maybe then opens up the idea that dual enrollment can be for everyone. But I also think it's just a conversation. We need to shift the mindset of teachers and principals and superintendents of everyone to start thinking about dual enrollment as something that we should encourage every child to do. We believe that every child can rise to that level of rigor.
And just to follow up, challenging the notion of the labels, I grew up in Puerto Rico, so Spanish is my first language, and I never had that label. And I'm sure if I had the same curriculum here, I would have been an ELL student. But I went to bilingual school and so forth. So, you know, having a label, I think, for certain populations and for certain teachers is problematic in my mind. Because I've heard of students saying, and adults now who were labeled that way, and how they are gone through the system, and how they didn't have the opportunities because they were still in that box. Mm-hmm. So just a challenging in terms of how can we use it to leverage it, not to get rid of them, but how do we leverage it to provide opportunities to that group, again, that can benefit the most. Thank you for your comments.
I think we may be several decades away from recognizing differences without belittling them. Would be ideal.
Thank you, Ms. Hall. And did I read a story about you once you were going to go to medical school?
I was.
Thought you could save more lives. And I just wanted to tell you, all of you, you're awesome. So we need to go to our next group. And thank you so much. And we'll go next to Ms. Suffet, then Mr. Smart, and Katie Smith. Welcome.
Thank you for having us here today.
Stop at the 2001 and 2002 Teacher of the Year.
I am, and I will just explain that was a shift with Education Minnesota in when they named it. I wasn't named twice. I just served twice. We'll be able to help you with the time a little bit, because Mike and I are actually tag teaming. I taught for 5 years in the St. Cloud area, and for 24 years in the Hopkins School District. During my time in Hopkins, and right around the time when I was named Teacher of the Year, there was a movement to provide differentiation for students. So students that had who were showing some like tendencies in either interest or achievement, I would group together in a class while the rest of the class was doing something else. I would pull a group of students that I wanted to work with in a smaller setting. And then they would be released to do some tasks, and I would pull another group. And differentiation was necessary to move students where we wanted them to be. We now, because of technology, can move to personalization. And it's personalization in education right now that can provide the platform necessary so that students can take AP and IB classes without having any of the barriers that have currently been there. So if we take a look at personalized learning, which, you know, is an add-on to differentiation, personalization wasn't possible when I was differentiating because we didn't have the technology. But now that we do have it, we have the ability to raise the level of engagement of our students. So I would really encourage us as a state to really look deeply into personalization. But as Mike will explain, there are some barriers to that.
Thank you. I know Senator Wieger, you asked us to introduce ourselves first. I'd like to start with where I'm from, because I think that will segue into who I am, so I'll kind of get there in a moment. But I'm with District 287, and often when I mention that, I see people look up on the top.
Just for our tape, Mike Smart.
Yes, Mike Smart, yes. Thank you for having us. that often when I mention I'm from District 287, I see people looking up in the top of their head saying, where is that? And we're actually an intermediate school district. So we serve the 12 member districts in the West Metro area of the Twin Cities. And the way we kind of describe what we do is we say we do the things that school districts find hard to do on their own. So oftentimes a member school district will approach us with a specific population of students and say, you know, we're looking to improve the efficacy of our education with this group of students, or we'd like you to help us design a solution using your expertise with these students. The result of that is that we have 75% of our students are special education students, 20% are at-risk students, and 5% are gifted and talented. So we literally have no one in the middle. My topic today is about innovation, and I mentioned that district because I think the district has a tradition, our district has a tradition of providing unique solutions for a wide variety of member districts, so we have our finger in a lot of the different issues and populations and problems that exist today in education. My role with the district, when I was selected as 2007 Minnesota Teacher of the Year, at that point in time I had been a Japanese teacher in several districts through our World Languages program in the West Metro area. And for the past 6 years, however, I've been heavily involved with innovation in our school district. My official title right now is Innovation Facilitator. And innovation was one of the three prongs of our strategic plan from 5 years ago to last year. So one of the things that we looked at, we were really charged with how to making innovation more vibrant in our system and more vibrant in our district. And one of the challenges we had is that a lot of times innovation ends up as kind of a poster on the wall. I mean, everybody agrees what it is, but it isn't really meaningful in terms of something that people will actually do and use. So we took a look at all the research out in the private sector. We wanted to look at corporations and organizations that were kind of viewed by the public as being particularly innovative. We looked at all of that, and then we said, how can we use all of this research and apply it to an educational setting? And there are really two things that we came up with that I think are at the core of this innovation effort that we've had in our district. The first is we looked at Google's model of their 20% time for engineers, where basically they take some of their engineers and they say, okay, one day a week you can work on a project that's your own project. And they looked at the outcomes and the efficacy of that. And we said, what if we took a concept like that and applied it to education? So we created a position in our district called Innovation Coaching. And basically, we have now a team of anywhere from 10 to 14 coaches, depending upon the year. It's in the fifth year of its existence right now, where we've taken some of our more creative and kind of out-of-the-box thinkers. They could be educational assistants. They could be teachers. We're not really interested in the labels, as Senator Francis, but we're interested in qualifications of the person. And we've given them a mandate that said, take this time, anywhere from 10 to 40% of your day, work with the staff and students at your site, and your mandate is this, to create projects that increase student learning and increase staff efficiency. And then we kind of sit back and watch what they did. Now, when we first thought they started doing this, we thought the projects would oftentimes be small scale. It'd improve instruction in a particular classroom or something like that. What we quickly learned is that the projects and ideas that came up with from staff and from students and from these innovation coaches segued into much larger projects. In each of the first 5 years of the initiative, this team of roughly a dozen innovation coaches spearheaded over 100 projects a year that involved increasing student learning or increasing staff efficiency. Some of them were as simple, some of them were as wide and varied. For example, we have a backpack program now where one of our innovation coaches noticed students were going home on the weekends and they were hungry. And so he worked with local charities to send 70 of our kids home every weekend now with a backpack full of food. Because if you're hungry, you can't learn. I'd like to talk a little bit now about three kind of projects that started out small that have grown into big, and then draw some conclusions I think that we can make from a purposeful kind of approach to innovation within education. The first program that I'd like to mention is our app development program. 75% of our students are special education students, and our special education teachers, when we started using iPads with students, noticed that there were a lot of educational apps, but there weren't a lot of educational apps specifically tailored for special education students. The buttons might be too small, they're too complicated, there's too many distractions within the app. So our teachers asked one of our innovation coaches, they said, could we create our own apps that are better suited for special education students? And so we try to say yes to things, and that's led now, this is the fifth year of its existence, we have two apps in the iTunes store that have sold and downloaded over 20,000 copies. We're submitting our third app this month. Our fourth app is in development, and we're with negotiations now with a developer to begin production on our fifth app. They've received really good reviews. I've also given, you should have a handout that has a link to kind of the apps and things. There's a QR code there. You can check these out in more detail later. So I don't want to belabor the time on that. But we're very happy with the results of that. And that's something that, again, grew from the simple question of, could we do things better with the apps that are out there than currently exist? A second program is the Minnesota Partnership for Collaborative Curriculum. And this started from actually a problem. We believe that innovation oftentimes starts from problems. A few years ago, Minnesota changed the requirement that the Minnesota Studies class would move from fifth grade to sixth grade. Well, there was no book for the course. So some of our member districts came forward and said, can we kind of come up with some sort of solution for this? And the answer was, what if we created a digital course that could be delivered on a variety of learning management systems? It could be delivered in a traditional manner. It could be delivered in blended, flipped, or in a virtual and online manner as well. What if we got member district teachers together and administrators to create a rigorous process that designs a course aligned to Minnesota standards that's open educational resources so it then in turn can be given away to any school district in the state? That project got favorable reviews. It was extraordinarily well received. And that's kind of segued into a project now, which is the Minnesota Partnership for Collaborative Curriculum. We have over 140 Minnesota school districts that are participating in this. The goal is to build a digital course that will be given away to everyone who wants it that's centered on Minnesota state standards. And there will be four courses of each of the grade levels in the core areas through grades 3 through 12. I believe there are 6 or 7 courses that are currently completed, and it's on target to be completed in a couple of years. So it's a tremendously exciting project. I always get the number wrong because it seems like every year, every month, or every week or so, we're getting new districts that are jumping on board to that project. And again, that started from the simple question of what can we do when we don't have a book to help teach this curriculum? The last project I'd like to mention is our West Alternative Program. 20% of our students are at-risk students, and a lot of my compatriots have talked a little bit about the issues that center around at-risk students. We noticed in many cases that at-risk students can't keep up or haven't kept up with pacing in traditional educational environments. And so some of our teachers asked the simple question, in a traditional educational system, time is the constant and achievement is the variable. So over the course of a semester, if you get 95% of the stuff, well, you've got an A. If you get 80% of the stuff, you get a B. If you get 50% of the stuff, you only learn half the stuff. Sorry, that doesn't count. You don't get any credit. And we said, well, what if we kind of flipped that equation? What if we made achievement the constant and time the variable? One of the things I think of oftentimes when I talk about this is when I grew up, and because many times I think education delivers things along set pathways that are really independent of the learning needs of a student. The story that I like to tell along this lines is when I grew up, we had the Grinch. And the Grinch was a Christmas special, many of us know this, that was shown once a year. And if you grew up and you're a 7-year-old, 8-year-old kid, the Grinch was on, say, December 10th from 7 o'clock in the evening to 7:30 in the evening. And if you missed it, you missed it. You had to wait another year to be able to see the Grinch. And we think now, in today's world, that would be absurd. We'd get Netflix. We'd borrow the DVD from somebody else. There's a plethora of places where we can get the Grinch now. But in many ways, when we look at kind of what's going on in education, we see that we're teaching students like we're ABC in the 1960s. If you don't get fractions in those 2 weeks in October when they're taught, you have to wait another year or another semester. And that compounds the problem because everything that's built off of fractions leads that kid to fail. So we said, what if we gave kids enough time to work through those trouble spots? And we flipped the equation, giving kids enough time they need to get the work done. Now, we brought that forward to administrators and teachers, and I'd say 75% of the administrators and teachers that we talked to thought we were crazy. They said, you're going to have kids, at-risk students, working at their own pace. They won't do anything. So we went out and we hired the 25% that didn't think we were crazy, and we created and we opened our West Alternative Learning Program last fall. Last fall, the end of their first year last spring, their achievement was on par with our other alternative learning centers in their first year of existence. So despite all the challenges of having a new program, we were very happy with those results. I was talking to the program facilitator yesterday, and he mentioned that they're on pace right now to double their achievement from last year. So they're 2.5 times their October achievement of that there in this year. We're finding that students, at-risk students, can do this. It takes a while to shift kind of to a growth mindset, to a different mindset. There's a lot of things that have to go right. We're learning a lot and we're tweaking it, but it's been a very exciting program that we think leads to a lot of potential with at-risk students. Those three examples, I think they all started out strong. I think if there's some conclusions we could draw from that, is, one, they all resulted from a very purposeful look at innovation and innovation research. One of the things that we've done with our innovation coaches, we bring them together on a monthly basis, and we provide very specific training on how ideas diffuse through organizations. We bring research on creativity. We bring research on important social connections and social networking in terms of spreading ideas and innovation through an organization. The second thing is that none of these things could have existed 5 to 10 years ago. The idea that you could create your own app would have been too expensive. There wasn't a device to run it on 10 years ago. It couldn't be done. The ideas that districts could collaborate on digital curriculum was inconceivable. The Google Plus, Fuse, Skype wasn't out there so that we could create a network of collaboration to do this. We couldn't build the digital content in our West Alternative Learning Program in the way that we can right now to drive this program. So we think there's a tremendous importance in education to solving today's problems, not with yesterday's solutions, but solving them with tomorrow's solutions. The third thing I think that's a key mark of all these things is that they increase the amount of teacher interactions with students. One of the misguided efforts, I think, with technology is that it reduces the personal touch. We look at technology often to replace teachers, when the research shows that actually judicious and personal kind of infusion of technology requires more teacher input. One of the things that we ask of programs is we ask students, how well do you know your teacher after we've added technology? And if after the inclusion of technology, the students say they know their teachers less, we know we're doing it wrong. Because all the successful programs that bring a flipped or a flex environment to a classroom situation mention that students get to know their teachers better. The last thing is, these really don't cost us more money. The app development program is kind of funding its development based on the proceeds and sales from its existing apps now. The alternative program that we run is just done on standard funding. There isn't extra funding allotted for that. The Minnesota Partnership for Collaborative Curriculum, each district kicks in $1 per district to provide, to be a member in the development of the courses. And so these are things, and kind of standing in front of a finance committee talking about we don't need money might sound odd, but there is a catch and there is a caveat, and in fact is that we actually do need money in many situations. And it's those foundational issues that allow this type of innovation to happen. There was a recent Stanford study that came out 2 weeks ago that mentioned they surveyed teachers in low-income schools, and 97% of teachers in low-income schools said that their students do not have the resources to use technology outside of the school environment. And that goes beyond a lot of what we're seeing. We're currently working to kind of bring to scale that alternative model, the flex model that we use in our West Alternative Program. And we're currently working with another school district, and our conclusion that we drew last week is we can't do it because they don't have the bandwidth and they don't have the devices. So that would be something I think that I don't necessarily have the solution for this, but I know what the solution is. The solution is that we get kids access to devices, and the solution is that we get sufficient bandwidth to drive these programs. That's the groundwork that needs to happen. Compounded this, I was talking to Barb beforehand. Compounding this is a bigger question because it ties into referendums. You know, we've talked, Jackie, you get a referendum in a district where you've got the technology resources, it really allows this type of stuff to explode. But a district that can't pass that referendum is crippled in these kind of initiatives. So I think that's a challenge for you there in terms of how do we look at that in terms of moving forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Technology, Senator Pratt, followed by Senator Weber. And
okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I really enjoyed your testimony because from the innovation standpoint, both from the students who are struggling, but I'm also seeing the explosion of hybrid programs, which allow students to study at their own pace. But my experience with technology is sometimes the technology gets ahead of the purpose, and what I've seen is the implementation being slowed down by getting teachers trained on the technology. And how do you address those problems?
I think that goes into the idea that I alluded to a little bit with a very purposeful training regime with that. We noticed that with our alternative program last year, that even though we cherry-picked these teachers to be teachers that were open to the idea of using technology and teaching in different ways under a flex model, I mean, there's some direct instruction, there's some digital instruction, there's a lot of one-to-one tutoring and small group instruction that goes on in this environment. So it's really a variety of teaching methods. what's really interesting is that when you mention technology or a digital course to people, even people who are familiar with it often assume that digital equals online equals a bunch of students sitting in a room with computers and no human interaction. And I think that a lot of it is an awareness issue. A lot of it's a training issue. We've gone in and worked with the staff over the course of last year to really bring an awareness that, no, this isn't what it should look like. We've gone in and we've modeled this type of behavior, that this is what this instruction should really kind of look like. The exciting part of that now, I think, is that we're starting to get examples where this worked. We need good examples because it's so much easier for a teacher, a staff, an administrator to look at an existing program and see how that works and then be able to replicate that. It's hard to envision what happens if you haven't seen it happen before. So we're really trying to be more purposeful of getting out and looking at other programs that do this so that we can all learn from each other. So I think that there's a general level of an awareness within education that involves training. It involves a very specific focus on bringing the skills and awareness to staff and teachers that this is how it's done.
And it's also bringing that same awareness to students. It's teaching them that this device is not just a toy. This is the new coloring in the lines. You know, we teach students how to use this as a learning device. We know that they come to us with this being something that they played with. So teaching them how to use this in the classroom is the new coloring in the lines.
And I think even too with the flex and the flip mode, to kind of segue off what Barb said, a lot of our kids go through their educational system being told exactly what to do every single day. They're used to coming into a school environment and they're kind of metacognitive awareness is very low. They're told what to do. They're told to do a worksheet. When you flex model, when you flip an educational system, oftentimes what's now required is that transition. Not only do you have to adjust your mindset toward the technology, you have to adjust your mindset that you are the shepherd of your own educational career. When kids get that, we see a tremendous amount of growth. Until kids get that, they'll often wait for something to happen to them.
And that's why we need the teacher to move from the front of the classroom to the middle of the classroom.
Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for your presentation, and certainly it's a joy joy to hear your enthusiasm as you talk about this. The question that I had coming into today, and I've decided that this is you're going to be the ones that I ask it of, dealing with the fact you have a bunch of politicians, legislators in front of you, and sometimes I think we fall into the trap we all understand that there's a need for money, and so budgets get increased, and we go home and say, well, we've done our job, and let it go at that. But yet we come back the next year, and the same problems exist, one of being the achievement gap here in Minnesota. And I guess, you know, I wanted to ask those of you who have achieved the designation of Teacher of the Year, you know, what do we need to do different within the system in order to deal with that? Because I don't think that always just throwing money is necessarily achieving the desired result. And I think you are probably in a topic here that we maybe need to be going. But I just like you to expand your thoughts concerning that particular issue.
And I'd open it up to anybody here, too, if you want to make comments on this, because it's obviously something we're all well-versed on.
Right.
Leanne, I think, will address
specifically
later, but I'm not sure, Barb, you...
Right, and I think that personalized learning definitely does form that partnership between all of the learners in the classroom, which moves everyone forward. So just like we want teachers working and collaborating together to plan and evaluate quality instruction, we want students doing the same thing. But I do know that Leanne is covering that more later.
Okay.
I think, too, one of the background elements to the innovation program that we've tried to institute in our district is really based on the work of Tayek and Cuban, who wrote a kind of a summative treatise on 100 years of educational reform. And it's called Tinkering Towards Utopia. And we really looked at that as to a certain degree as a model for our program, which was the idea that there isn't really one panacea out there. There isn't one cure that's going to fix the achievement gap. In many ways, to a degree, it is very much a societal issue. I mean, if you look where the achievement gap is focused, it's very much focused in areas of poverty. That's a huge factor in the achievement gap. So we think, though, that the research has shown that there are the pockets of innovation that then can spread. Their conclusions were that small, incremental grassroots change can lead and has led to some of the more significant educational reform over the past 100 years. So we think anything that you can do as politicians to create that type of environment where that can flourish can help us get to things. I mean, talking about Senator Franzen's comment about labels and thinking about that. That is part of closing the achievement gap. I think in their purposeful approach to growth mindset instruction, where Carol Dweck's work on growth mindset and fixed mindset is incredibly powerful, maybe incorporating that into teacher evaluations. It's going to be a bunch of little things. It's not going to be one big thing that we can walk home and say we're done with.
Senator Pearson, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Smart, this is a big question, and so I understand if you can't get to all of it. Standards are, we have a standards-based system, and they're inherently one-size-fits-all, right? I mean, they're state standards. Given, your discussion about innovation and differentiated teaching and learning and personalization and technology, and I don't think they're mutually exclusive, standards-based assessments and innovation, but what role in your mind should standard-based assessments play in our education system? And I understand that's a huge question, but I think it's appropriate given sort of the conversation about innovation and differentiated instruction.
I think that the bigger question even behind that, too, is one of accountability. And I don't think I have an accurate answer there in terms of, because I think when we look at the public's view of the educational sphere, the public wants to know its money's well spent. And so there's a certain element of accountability to the system that the belief is testing provides. So I'm not really sure what the alternative is in there in terms of how we get that with an effective system. I do think, though, that a standard line you hear, and I think it is very much a standard line because it's a valid line. So it's very difficult to get at true learning with a standards-based test. When we talk about what we're asking our kids to do and the skills they need to learn in today's environment, that idea of think, create, and share, the do-it-yourself movement, I think is incredibly powerful. I've seen my own kids now in a school district where they're given opportunities to do this, and they come to life. They absolutely adore the projects they do, and the learning is deeper and it's richer. So I think that there isn't an easy way to measure that in a test. So whatever system we devise to kind of has to incorporate that type of achievement and that type of growth. I don't think standardized tests get anywhere close to that, and that's, of course, the gap. So I could talk for a long time on that. I do think, though, those are some of the key issues that surround it.
I was going to ask what it's like to have a last name like Smart going through.
Anyway, it'd be nice if it were true. Okay.
We're going to switch now to early learning. Kate Smith, we 2011 Teacher of the Year, and you have a video. We have technology support in case we need that, too. Yeah. So if you'd like to introduce that, and we'll
proceed.
Will.
My name is Katie Smith. I come to you from Winona, Early Childhood Family Education. I teach parent education there. I have this is my 27th school year. I watched you watch Mr. Smart, and so I will give you this for him. I mean, really, I saw you, so... Rocket. I also feel a little betrayed because we were on the Capitol steps and he said, "Do you still get nervous?" And I said, "Oh, heck yeah." And he said, "So do I." And I saw no evidence of that. So he's going to buy me lunch later. I will tell you that I hope each and every one of you have been invited to an early childhood family ed birthday party. It's our 40th. And if you haven't, we're celebrating in Winona at 4:30 to 5:30. You can come downriver with me, and I will get you a great piece of cake on the edge if you'd like, so you get just the right amount of frosting. I also have to tell you this. Man, oh, man. Last session, if I were to describe it in terms of early childhood, I think the message is loud and clear from you. Do more. Do better. Do it well. We are counting on you. You've invested pretty heavily in early childhood, and we know it. In fact, it makes me a little choked up. I've waited for that session for a long, long time. And I believe it is the key, one of the biggest keys to the achievement and the opportunity gap. And so I want you to know that I represent lots of educators all over the state that take that to heart and are planning on it and actually dreaming bigger than we ever have in a long time because of the nods that you gave us in terms of scholarships, in terms of investing in ECFE again, in terms of talking about early childhood the way you did. And didn't we talk? And talk and talk and talk and take ownership of the fact that when we do better by our youngest learners in Minnesota and when we support their families and their parents and we change a culture of childhood, we have a real shot at this. So thank you very much. I'm excited about and I'm dreaming big about working with our birth to grade 3 alignment in providing parent education from kindergarten to grade 3. You've loosened up the reins for me a little bit, and I'm so excited about that. I would love parent education to go all the way through high school. You know I will. And so I will be that lady here long after I retire with a long gray braid saying, I could keep going, right? And I would, and I would, and I would. It's the key. When parents know what we expect of their kids in school, when they know better, they do better. So I am excited about the work in early childhood initiatives all over the state. I've spoken to more professionals who care for our youngest learners in terms of family daycare providers, child-centered child care workers all over to build the capacity of those folks and get them in the game with us, that the work we do is the most important work that we do in the state of Minnesota. I fantasize with them about, you know what, just think, like of not going to work for a couple of days. Minnesota would shut down. When our kids are well cared for, when they're 0 to 3, we all work better. And so I love the idea of building the capacity of those folks that care for the youngest Minnesotans. So I'm just going to tell you one story. Where we are now is in spirited conversation all over the state. You'll find me and a 22-year-old teacher, and we'll be going on and on about what is developmentally appropriate. And is it right to test little children? And what does school readiness really mean? And I understand that we're getting closer and closer to that definition so that we can all work together, and I understand the importance of it. I hope that every one of you have seen a 14-month-old go down the steps on the very first day that they decide they can turn around and do it face first. It's daunting because their legs are little and those steps are real big, and they're used to going down on their tummies or on their bottoms, but this day they decide to be brave and they hold on for dear life. And I will tell you that 90% of those 14-month-olds will take one step and have their foot match. And they'll take another step, and they'll have the foot match. And they'll go down the steps like that, tongue out, holding tight, but super excited about this adventure. Have you seen it? It's so great. Here's the deal. Everyone in about 100 of those 14-month-olds manages to do it alternately, foot after foot after foot. What? What? If that becomes our standard for the other 99% of the kids, if you want me to, take their legs and force them to go alternately, that kid is going to lose some joy in the journey. When in 6 months, every single kid will be able to do it foot after foot after foot, I just want you to hold that story in terms of what do we expect our littlest kids to do. When they're going to get there anyway, naturally, in their own path and in their own kind of journey through childhood, let's be careful about what we expect of them. You asked me to dream big, and I love that I'm sitting here with the technology guys. Most of you know I have some pretty strong feelings about the amount of technology we put in our kids' brains. I think it's a factor in the achievement gap, is how many hours kids are watching a violent media during their early childhood years. And so really, you asked me to dream big. So what would it be like if you took your son to preschool screening, and when you registered him, I sent you a 5-minute video. And just here's one example of maybe 3 or 4 or 5 that the state of Minnesota says, here's what we believe in, is a confident and safe and wonderful journey for your kids to enter kindergarten. And we'll send it to you. We have some standard curriculum that will help you know better so you can do better. I can't tell you how nervous I am about this. I've worked on it for 2 years since Sandy Hook. I have to tell you, after that week, I decided I had to do something professionally to take that on. We're going to come up on 2 years of it, and we've really not addressed what the problem is. It's not the only solution, but one of the solutions is the amount of media we're exposing our kids to and how frightening it is for them. And they're not able to tell us when to stop. So I'll offer you this, and I'm so confident because Mike Smart is sitting next to me, and he's a technology guy, that if this doesn't go, we'll figure it out real fast. It's 5 minutes and 30 seconds of your time, and while you're watching it, it's my big dream come true to take a picture of you doing it. So try to look engaged.
There's no picture.
No, there's no picture. Is there a picture here, you guys?
I think the TV's
I am. My hands are shaking, but oh.
It's Mike. On.
Is it?
No.
Just about.
TV's on, but the titty is not coming through. No.
What do we need to do, Mike?
No, it's a great she's engineer. Come on, help us out.
Please wait. Oh.
There.
Yeah.
There you go. Do you want to rewind it for me? My hands are shaky. I
need to make the right people there.
Yep.
Okay, I'll figure out my
answers. I can't even transfer. Wait, can I take your message? I'll call you.
You're public.
I can sure take a question while Mike's helping. Let's make use of our time, right? Do you see anything?
Some writing.
Which side was
it on? I think you can make it full screen.
Good.
And because little people are little sponges, they're taking it in, so is it what we want them to take?
It's the kid's job to push against the limits. That's what their job is. That's what kids have always done. That's the tough part of parenting. What we need to do is make the decisions that we think that are appropriate for our kids at the age at which they are, and then stick with them.
Research tells us that 90% of the brain wires before a child is 5 years old. Knowing that, it makes perfect sense to pay close attention to what we're exposing our young children to.
Hey! Because whatever the brain does a lot of is what the brain gets good at. Whether it's tennis, whether it's math, whether it's texting, whether it's video games.
It's true that you put a kid in front of a screen and they'll seem to enjoy it very much, but it's not necessarily good for them.
School-age children spend only 50 hours a week with some kind of a screen. And so it's become a very big part of their lives.
Kids are so bombarded with images and sound and lights and music that they really don't have that same kind of time that kids used to just be themselves in their brain.
And it's not appropriate for them as their brain is still developing and taking things in. If media is going to be used with children, it needs to be supervised well. Know who's watching your children. Don't let the TV or some sort of media babysit your child. You know, would you leave your child with a stranger?
Long before kids can articulate that they're bothered by what they're taking in on screens, they show us that they're bothered with their behavior and sometimes with speeches. They don't have the vocabulary to process those questions that the television show raised for them, but they're bothered by it. It's in their psyche. So kids are telling us in lots of different ways, please take a look at this. This isn't good for us. You wouldn't throw a baby into the deep end of the pool to teach them to swim. And you wouldn't introduce a baby to solid foods by putting hot wings and an energy drink in front of them. And yet, that's kind of what we do when it comes to media. We give way too much food to kids, and it's way too spicy for them.
Kids learn by imitation. They always have, they always will.
You know, they're going to do it because they've seen it done, and they're fearless. On Monday mornings, we can really kind of get an idea of what children did over the weekend. You know, boom, a shelf will go down in the child care center. You're like, well, wait a minute, you're not the crusher. You know, you're really going to get hurt if somebody's
You know, a friend of mine told me about an intervention that his four-year-old son, you know, Dad, would you please put that away? I'm trying to talk to you. The years that I have with my son are going to go by very, very quickly. And the opportunity to make those important connections become very, very important. How often do we kind of taken away by our smartphones or by, you know, modern technology?
It's much more important that the real adults in their lives step up to be role models and storytellers of their world. It's important for kids to learn about their world and behave in the world from the adults that are in their lives, not the adults they see on screen. Media comes in lots of different forms, on televisions, on iPads, on computer screens, and not all media is bad. There's actually some really healthy choices for kids out there. It's important for parents, though, to take a look and do some screening and make sure the media is appropriate for their child and that they're not giving kids too much of it.
You want them to be a child and have a joyful childhood and not have adult worries as young as they are.
About how much media, what type, when?
I know what we're asking parents to do is hard. We're asking them to pay attention to how much media kids are consuming, pay attention to what's recommended for kids at every age. We're asking parents to pay close attention to the content and make sure not to expose kids to violent media. It seems hard now, but these are decisions that in the short term are difficult to enforce, but in the long term, are decisions that parents really appreciate putting time and effort into.
What if our preschool scholarships came with digital parent education? And that we could do a movie on reading, we could do a movie on routine and structure, we could do all of that digitally for every Minnesotan. We see them at preschool screening at 3.5, a good proportion of them. It would be fantastic to find different ways to deliver parent education beyond our ECFE classrooms. Most ECFE classrooms have had to meet the needs of their own particular communities. We have to fill our seats or we don't fly. And so every community has a different kind of offering, which is lovely. But I love the idea of asking more of us. And I'll tell you, we're up for the challenge and real excited about the possibilities. So happy birthday to all of us. Thank you for investing in my personal favorite investment in Minnesota's youngest learners with ECFE, and I appreciate the partnership that we have seemed to form over the last couple of years and are happy to work on the achievement gap with the rest of my colleagues in this room and all over the state. So thank you very much for having us. Appreciate it so much.
Thank you, Ms. Smith, and for sharing your inspiring dream in the video. Senator Rood.
I enjoyed the video.
Thank you very much.
Before coming down yesterday, I had a conversation with a few teachers, and I asked, you know, if there was a question that I could talk about, what would that be? And one of their concerns is the fact that the state law says that September 1 is the kindergarten age. And so they have this group of children that they spend a whole lot of time with. But May to September, they're just that much younger, and they are just that much behind the rest of the group. And it seems like maybe by the time they're in third grade, they all catch up. But a lot of time and classroom time is spent on that small group of children that are really maybe a little more immature. They're learning. And so their idea was maybe that should be changed in statute, that maybe September 1 is a little far out for the children, because it does create a learning gap so early, and we know that you know when they're playing catch up at an early age, it just takes longer down the road.
Right. So wouldn't it be ideal if we had preschools in our schools and fed kids to kindergarten when they were really ready to be there? You know, and it wouldn't necessarily determine their birth date, but we would have a matrix to know this is what a kid who's ready for kindergarten. And so it's November 1st, head on in, you're ready, rather than wait a whole nother year. Or hang out with us for a little while, even though you're 5.5 here in preschool, because this is where you need to be. I think the more a attention we pay in those early years is where we'll figure that out. When we come up with the definition, right now it's September 1st, and that is it. This is what a child who's ready for kindergarten, it has a birthday on or before September 1st. And I will tell you that if I lined up 10 kids with a September 1st birthday, you'd go, holy cow, wow, there's a vast difference between those kids. So I echo their concerns, and yep, and I love the idea of bringing all those kids into school as preschoolers.
Just as a follow-up.
Yeah, Senator Wood.
I know in Pequot Lakes we have moved the group up into, we took the fifth graders and moved them and put the EFC in our elementary school.
Nice.
Just trying to address that problem. And mm-hmm. So as we go down the road, maybe we can keep that an idea how that is not such a, you know, definite date.
Right.
You know, maybe it should be more on readiness so that when the teachers have these children in their classroom, they are truly ready to move forward.
Right. I love the idea of the scholarships. I do. I also will tell you that you will compound that investment when you include their parents in some parent education. Yeah. You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you to each of the testifiers. We're going to go to our next two. At this point, I want to commend each of the members, and we have over a fourth of the Minnesota Senate here. Your attention has been riveting, and everyone's here, throughout, and that's a testament to you. So I want to commend the members for that. We're going to go next to Leanne Stevens, the 2006 Minnesota Teacher of the Year, and she'll be followed by Superintendent Robert Metz. Welcome.
Hi, it's so good to be back again, and thank you so much. I have some students who are probably not real excited that I'm here. That's kind of why I'm on the end, because I was going to be doing a lot of AP psychology study sessions with them today. So, but I'm glad to be here. And I am Leanne Stevens, as was said, and I work at St. Louis Park High School. And this actually is my superintendent, so it's so nice to have him. He's my principal, now he's my superintendent, so it's good to have him. I have a very special role. I am so honored, and I tell them all the time that it's such an honor and a privilege for me to be able to serve the students for whom I serve, and I serve Latino and African American students who take advanced placement classes, international baccalaureate classes, and honors classes. And so I'm their advocate. And so often people think, well, why would you have that role? And so it's one thing to get them in the courses, the advanced courses, but then to be there as a support for them is really important. And so my superintendent, my former principal, was very committed to it. And the interesting piece of it, so often we think that it's the academic side that's so challenging for them. And that's not the most challenging piece. The most challenging piece is that they have to get past the amount of melanin in their skin to show that they really belong in those courses, because they have peers who don't really believe that they truly belong there, and so having their voice heard, so they have to get past this. And so I give them the tools to do that, to get past that. And so it's not only just giving them, being able to advocate for themselves, I also build huge relationships with them. Their character is really important for me as well. And I want them to debunk all the stereotypes that are attached to being a student of color, all the negative stereotypes. And so I work on that piece of it too, the character side of it for them. And so often they'll say, Mrs. Stevens, I don't know what I would do without you. I don't know how I could make it through high school without you. And I feel like every student needs to have an adult in the building where that's how they feel, that, man, I don't know how I would get through this high school experience without you. And so I love what I do, and it's not just from 7:30 or 8:30 to 3. Literally, I'm available for the students 24/7. They all have my cell phone number. I need to be that person for them. And it's real interesting, too, because we have conversations a lot about teacher diversity, because I'm the only black female teacher in my building. And we talk about it a lot. And I also let them know that it's a struggle for me, too. I've been teaching
for 25 years. And it's actually a second career for me. So I used to be a buyer. But anyway, it's all another story. That's why I like dresses so much. I wear dresses every day. But I went into teaching because I wanted to be a role model specifically for students of color. But also I feel like the white students also need to see teachers of color as well in their schools. And so teacher diversity is really, really important for me. So it's important for me now to be a role model to these students as well, because I feel like we talk about getting more teachers of color in our schools, but we don't have them in front of our students. And so what are we saying? I feel like, what message are we sending? We're sending a message that says, well, you know what? Teaching isn't for everybody. If you're white, teaching's for you. And so that's the kind of message that we're sending. And when we talk about the achievement gap, I think all of this plays a role into the achievement level of students. I mean, I know their story. I know their struggle. I don't use their story or their struggle as a crutch, because I will say to them, they'll say, oh, Mrs. Stevens, my life is so terrible and I have to do this. And I'll say, is that how you want to continue to live? Because if you think it's bad now, if you don't do what you need to do now to be successful, you're going to always live like that. And so I'm very candid with them, very open with them. So it's really important for me to know everything about them, know their struggle, but to be able to take them beyond that. And so accept them for who they are, but see them as someone, see where they can be. And so teacher diversity is really, really important. And it was kind of nice that I was on the tail end, because there's no topic there for me, so I could talk about it. But I feel like we talk a lot about the achievement gap. We talk, we meet, we have committees, we talk. And I wonder, are we really serious about it? Do we just want to continue to talk, or do we really want to close it? Because I'm telling you, we've had poor people forever. Poor people have been around since the beginning of time. Poor people can achieve. And so I am one of those people who, I don't really believe that poverty is the reason that we have this achievement gap. I think there are biases that come as educators. I think that we look at particular students and already assume things about them, assume things about their family. And so that, there are things that we can't control, but there are things that we can control. And I can control what I'm doing every single day in that classroom for that student. And I think there are times when we don't even ask them what they need from us. We assume what they need. We don't say, what do you need from me? Because I'll ask them, what do you need from me to help you become successful? Because it's more important for them to get what they need from me. Because I need to be the most uncomfortable person in my building. My students need to be the most comfortable. And I think so often it's the reverse. And so my point is that we need to stop talking so much about this achievement gap and actually doing something to close it. So I guess that's it.
Thank you, Ms. Stevenson. Before we open for questions, we'll go to the superintendent and we'll kind of blend in the conversation as we did on technology. Thank you. Superintendent Metz.
Yes, my name is Rob Metz. I'm the superintendent in St. Louis Park. This is my second year as superintendent. I was the high school principal. 6 years before that, I was an elementary principal in St. Louis Park for 9 years before that. And this is my 34th year working in schools. I'm here to talk about the ninth grade bar program in St. Louis Park. I want to talk about what Leanne was talking about. Maybe we can get to that. It kind of blends together in some places. The number one reason students don't graduate from high school is that they fail too many ninth grade classes. If you fail ninth grade classes, some bad things happen to you. Now you're in 10th grade, and you have to take all your 10th grade classes plus some of your ninth grade classes, and you really weren't the best student to begin with, and you start getting behind the eight ball, and you never catch up. You get to be 17, you count up your credits, you see that you're not going to have enough credits to graduate, and you drop out. We spend a lot of money tracking down 17-year-olds who have dropped out, trying to find them and bring them back into very expensive alternative programs or back into the high school to graduate. To me, the best remedy is to prevent them from dropping out in the first place, and the best way to do that is to earn all of your ninth grade credits. The title of St. Louis Park's ninth grade program is called BAR. It stands for Building Assets, Reducing Risks. The unique thing about it is that it's a non-academic approach, an asset-building approach to passing ninth grade classes. Before the BAR program began in St. Louis Park about 15 years ago, one out of three ninth graders failed at least one class. It was actually closer to 40%. The last couple of years, we've gotten that down to, at the lowest point, 12% of ninth graders that failed at least one class. When I was the high school principal, I could look at that number and say, 88% of ninth graders passed all their classes, and I would know 3 years later our graduation rate would be at least 88%. So how does it work? Well, I like to compare it to what I call the old factory model of school. So in my mind, here's the old factory model. There's seven different classes in the day. A student goes from class to class to class to class. Nobody knows what the first hour teacher has no idea what their other classes are, nor do they care what their other classes are, nor do they really care how well they're doing in their other classes. They just know their one class, and they care about that one class. And in the old way, the best teacher was the teacher that knew the most about their content. So if I knew the most about physics, I was considered a really good teacher, even though there's really no correlation between knowing the most about your content and being a good teacher. But that's the system we've used forever. I call it the survival of the fittest model, because for about a third of our students, navigating that factory model is not going to work. They're not going to make it through, and we know that. We've seen the data for decades, because they have to navigate seven different teachers, seven different contents, seven different personalities on their own, and they just can't do it. So what's different in the BAR model is that we still have the seven classes, but three of the seven are blocked into a team. And in our case, the block classes are science, social studies, and English. If there were three teachers here, there would be a science, social studies, and English teacher who share the same 90 ninth graders. So Leanne has 30, I have 30, this teacher has 30, and they rotate through our three classes. And then they take their other classes, any classes they want in the high school. Each of us are responsible to monitor 30 of the students. So for my 30, we get an hour a day, by the way, to meet. That's the key to this. So for an hour a day, every single day of the school year, the three of us meet and we talk about our 90 students. The goal is to get to know them so well that we can intervene and help them earn all of their credits. So I check my 30's grades every week in all seven classes, not just our three. And then between the three of us, we rate and rank them. We use a rating system where all of our 90 kids are rated a 0, a 1, a 2, or a 3. A 0 means they're passing all their classes. A 1 means they have one F somewhere on their grade sheet. A 2 means they have two Fs, and a 3 means they have multiple Fs. If this team is dedicated to this, they can get rid of almost all the 1s and 2s. So let's use a real-life example. Let's say that a student in my class is failing shop, and I put him on my list as a 1. And I say, does anybody know on our team why he's failing shop? Nobody knows. In fact, we see there's 7 of our 90 kids that are failing shop. So I say, okay, I know the shop teacher. I'm going to go talk to the shop teacher. Why are they failing shop? Because they won't do their safety test. Okay, so they come into Leanne's class now, and she's the English teacher, and Leanne has a good relationship with one of these 7 kids. And she says, why haven't you done your safety test in shop? This is an English class. Well, I don't like the teacher, and he wants me to stay after school to do it, and I have to go home after school, and I can't ride a bus. So we find out why, and then we go to the shop teacher and say, hey, how about this? We all teach third hour. We're going to write passes for our kids to get out of our classes third hour to go down to your shop class to take your safety test and then come back to our classes. And they do, and they're passing shop. So if this team follows those 90 students closely and intervenes in a way that holds them accountable, I always like to say that because What is holding someone accountable? Is it letting them fail shop? Is that holding them accountable? If you talk to the shop teacher, he would say, I'm teaching them a lesson. They haven't done their test. I told them they had to do their test. I'm not going to let them start. He thinks he's doing the right thing. He thinks he's holding them accountable. Where in reality, holding them accountable is making them do the work. It's making them do it. It's not letting them not do it. That's holding someone accountable. So if this team works well and their goal is to reduce failures in their block, they can get a lot of those failures off the failure list with the hour a day that they have working together. And get that failure rate down as low as possible. The nice thing is we're desperately trying to close the achievement gap in St. Louis Park. We are not even close, but there are little pockets of success, and this is one of them. This system works for white kids, it works for black kids, it works for brown kids. Our graduation rate last year was 89% at the high school, and it was 83% for black students. The state average was 57%, I think. Yeah. It was 80% for Hispanic students. The state average was 53%. If black and brown students pass all their ninth grade classes, they're going to graduate in 4 years most of the time. Now, there's a lot of team building here. There's some asset development. I can tell you that the reason students fail classes almost has nothing to do with how smart they are. In fact, I can't remember a time when a student failed a class in ninth grade at the high school because they weren't smart enough. It's all non-academic barriers to getting the work done. Now, this has been happening in St. Louis Park for about 15 years. 4 or 5 years ago, we got an I-3 grant, Investment in Innovation, from the federal government. They started testing this in other schools. They chose two small rural schools in Maine and one big school in Los Angeles area, Hemet, California. And at Hemet, they did a test where they had 600 ninth graders, and half of them did the old way of doing ninth grade, and half of them did the building assets, reducing risk way of doing ninth grade. And the results were very good, both in terms of credit and in terms of getting better at reading and math proficiency on the California tests. So last year, the federal government gave us a $20 million grant to keep testing this around the country. Now there are 12 trial sites where half the ninth grade is doing it and half isn't. And there are up to 50 schools that are getting a quick version of how to do this, and they're implementing it. So that's what this is, building assets, reducing risks. I should say one more thing about the assets. The assets were developed by Peter Benson Search Institute. 40 positive things that the more assets you have, the more successful you're going to be in school and in life. And we actually take time in ninth grade to teach 30 minutes a week of asset development by the science, social studies, and English teachers in their science, social studies, and English classrooms. So I will stop there. And
well, thank you very much. We will go for about 8 more minutes and adjourn. I'm going to take 3 questions, and then Senators Ray and I are going to give some committee announcements. Senators Peterson, Bonhoff, and Torres Ray for questions, and then we'll have some closing comments. Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. or Ms. Stevens. It's nice to meet you. I've talked to you once or twice on the phone. I don't know if you remember that or not. But this issue of minority teacher representation has been around since I've been in the legislature. And anytime you talk about race in general, it becomes sort of a politically charged conversation. And I'm someone who believes that everybody ought to be judged on the merit of what they do and what they say and not who they are. That said, some of the people who reject race as a component out of hand are the same people who advocate for things like local control. You know, and of course the reason they advocate for that is because local people have an understanding of the like circumstances that it takes to be successful in those given environments. And so, and then there's some people who make race everything, and they ignore every other part of the conversation, and I don't think either one of those is right. So it's got to be both. We've got a problem of underrepresentation, and so how would you How would you reconcile those two things? Obviously, we need more people of color in that leadership role in students' lives and communities where it certainly where it would seem appropriate, but at the same time, make sure that that's not solely the reason. So how do we make sure that we're getting teachers of color in the classroom at a greater rate without making it a quota, but making sure that every one of those teachers is also qualified and having a great impact on teaching and learning in the classroom? And I know that's another big question, right. But what are some of the things that you would suggest?
Well, one thing is... Leanne Stevens. No. Yeah. One thing is I get a little disturbed when every time we talk about getting a teacher of color, we always say it has to be a qualified teacher of color. And I literally, I'm telling you, and maybe this happens, but I never hear anyone say, we got to get a qualified white teacher in the classroom. I never hear that. So we equate diversity with having either muddying the waters and so that really bothers me. But that being said, I just had to say that because we use that a lot, and I only hear it when we talk about teachers of color. And so I think we do our students in this state a disservice by not having a more diverse staff. We do, and I'm going to tell you, because a personal experience for me, when I went to St. Louis Park, I taught in Minneapolis for about 12 years, and I went to St. Louis Park, and after the second, and I was at a predominantly white school, and after the second week, the one student said, well, Mrs. Stevens, how come you never taught ghetto? And it took me back, I was like, you know, I wanted to get a little, I was a little offended at first, but I thought, you know what, if that's the only image that he has of people who look like me, then I am in the right place. And so we really do. It's not just the black students and brown students who need teachers of color. White students need to see us in these roles as well. And we don't think about that. And so how do we do that? Well, there are barriers that we have set up, I feel like, as a state. We have licensing issues where people from out of state can't get a license here. That becomes a barrier. So there are barriers that are set up that prevent us from diversifying our staff. And we have to commit to it. We have to. There's a sense of urgency right now that we need to do it. Because obviously we're doing a good job of educating our white students. Is it because we have a majority white staff who can relate to them? I think we need to be honest. And I think that's the case. Can white teachers relate to black students? Absolutely. Can white students relate to brown students? Absolutely. But they need to see themselves reflected in that classroom. And it's not happening.
Superintendent, you're the chief executive officer.
What do you think? Want me to answer the same question?
Yes.
I think I agree with Leanne that we have to find a way to get it done. I know last statistic I saw was, I think, 15%, 10 to 15% of the students that graduated from teaching programs in Minnesota last year were students of color, were graduates of color. So every school district in the metro especially, is fighting over the same small group of graduates, trying to get them to come to St. Louis Park or Bloomington or Hopkins or Minneapolis or St. Paul. And we're fighting over a very small group of potential candidates to get them to our school. So the pool is very, very, very small. So I agree with Leanne that enlarging the pool is the task.
Sarah Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My comments are going to be on the same subject. So last year we enhanced our funding for the Q program because that in particular, you know, puts resources towards bringing teachers of color. And I've been a strong champion along with Senator Peterson on alternative licensure because some of those alternative programs have focused much more on the recruiting of teachers of color. We passed a law that directs the Board of Teaching to have a pathway for out-of-state teachers, and they haven't done it. And so, you know, that's something our committee really needs to address and understand, because that is a way to get teachers of color, as well as some of the changes around who gets to stay in the classroom. If we bring this new group in and then they get pink slipped because they're low on the totem pole, we've just shot ourselves in the foot. We've taken the very people that we desperately need and thrown them back out. So comments?
I agree. Everything that you said, you articulated it beautifully.
Thank
you. So I totally agree with that.
Thank you. And thank you for your great work, both of you. Wow.
He is amazing. He's been so supportive of me. And I'm going to tell you, all the students that I serve, every one of them graduate. Everyone. And they're Latino and African-American students. So it happens. And they go on to post-secondary education.
Senator Torres Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is for Mr. Metz. It's very clear that wherever I go in Minnesota, people will tell me that hiring teachers of color is really a number one priority. And I am mentoring right now a group of 20 girls that are ninth graders, and I have this honor of serving as the chair of the Education Committee. So before I agreed to be a mentor, I researched what it means to be a mentor and how can I have an impact. This is my second year, and it just so happened that organically we developed what you are doing in Minneapolis. Right. So in Roosevelt, I have 20 ninth graders that are Latina girls, and we're doing exactly what you're doing. The problem is that even in a place like Minneapolis, where we have a lot of diversity within the staff, I am the only person that they can talk to in their language that really speaks their language. And this is not just the Spanish. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about every single one of these girls have to go home to babysit. And I had no idea. I've been very removed from that conversation. None of these girls know how to swim. I was able to get them some lessons to go swim, to learn how to swim. They were not able to go to the Y, which is actually 7 blocks from their homes, because they had to babysit. I was able to get them a lot of access to programs. I've been able to get a lot of access to programs, and they are not able to do it because they don't have transportation, because they have to take care of their little kids. And they were embarrassed to tell me that last year. They just didn't want to tell me that they don't have a car to go, that they don't have money to pay for their bus, that they have to take care of their siblings. They were embarrassed to tell me all of that. Now they can tell me because we speak the same language. So my question to you is, why do you have only one African-American female teacher in your district?
Oh, it's not in your district, in my high school.
In your high school. So how many kids do you have right now in your district?
In our school district?
Yes. They look like Mrs. Stevens. And how many teachers are there now?
Yeah, there's probably
reflecting that population.
We have 4,600 students, and we're about 30% black, I would say, 30-35% black. And there's, do the math there, and there's probably less than five black teachers in St. Louis Park.
So, members, I just wanted to make that point because I think this is a really important issue. We have, in Minneapolis, we have the most diverse teacher population in the state of Minnesota, by far. By far, if you look at our demographic breakdown of teachers, it's just huge. It's incredibly good, very positive. Yet we have significant gaps that we're not able to meet the need of all the kids that come to our classrooms. So this is a very significant issue, and maybe this is a good time for me to talk about my next announcement as a chair of the Education Committee. I have been approached by multiple members of our committee, Senator Kent in particular, Senator Carlson, Senator Franson, who are very interested in really figuring out how to connect these pieces. And, of course, you know, Senator Bonhoeff has worked on this, Senator Uyghur, Senator Johnson. I mean, I can name everyone in this committee who really believe that these pieces need to be connected, part of really building a workforce, in this case, that works for our kids, building that quality, building the support that you are asking for right now, the time. How interesting that many of you said, we don't even need the money. Nobody says that to us. So nobody comes to our committee and say, we're not asking for money here. So it's very unique. But we hear that. We hear that what you want is our support, that you want us to give these districts the flexibility and the opportunities to build that support for teachers. And I, for one, am determined to do that next year. So I have asked members of the committee to please bring those ideas as to how we can put together the resources that already exist in terms of the 2% set aside, the QComp, and I know this is very controversial. This is very interesting. You would think that this should not be controversial, and it's so controversial that we're trying to get all of this funding that exists, and we're trying to build a system to train teachers, to support teachers, and to build an infrastructure of support for teachers. That's so PC. People will say, oh, perfect. Oh, well, go ahead and do it, and you will see how we get so many people who are opposed to this or who have ideas that are just really not coming together. But I think that we need to take it on because we're not going to be able to deal with the achievement gap unless we do that. So we have several members who have expressed interest in doing this, and they want this to be the number one priority for the next session. So I would like to take on that responsibility with them, and this is, we really need your help, and we need your support, and we need superintendents, we need principals, and we need teachers saying, this is how it's going to be done. Whether we like it politically or not, this is what works. And that's what we need to hear from you. And I am looking forward to hear your ideas. The members who are here that represent you, please connect with your senators. Let them know what is the number one priority, whether we like it or not politically, whether we think we can move it or not politically. We need to do quality work in this area. And we really need your help with that. So that's, members, something that I would like to ask for your, I know that Senator Kent has been talking to me again and again and again and say, okay, let's meet and talk about this. So I really appreciate your insistence on this because it's really important that we do it. And for everyone else, that's something that we're going to take on right away.
Thank you, Senator Torres-Ray. And first, to our testifiers, thank you so much for a great job. This
thank
has
you.
Been so inspiring. And I want to also thank particularly Megan Hall, you know, helped organize the various speakers. Many of you members, you have shared with me your priorities for upcoming session. And to an extent, that I had asked them then to comment. People who 24/7, this is their lives, and want to, and the best, what they see on these issues. So we will be seeing a lot more. You have handouts from them, contact information, and again, we will be following up on each of these topics during the upcoming session. In terms of our own E-12 Finance Committee, we have two meetings scheduled at this point for the balance of the year. I mean, there's only 70 days left. I mean, time's flying. And but November 13, what's next for school facilities hearing? That'll be at 9 a.m. Room 15 here. We'll ask Dr. Melcher, and there'll be others here. You'll recall there had been a facilities task force with a number of recommendations a year ago, and we'll be rolling out some thoughts, recommendations as to what to do. Early education on December 8th. And as you heard, we and know we have invested a lot more in resources, but we're going to do a check as to where we're at and gather recommendations from various stakeholders and others on recommendations. Additionally, I've asked you if any of you have particular needs or concerns for priorities that you want to discuss. I've heard from many of you, or if you want to come to the district. I believe I'll be going down to Laverne on November 25, and Sandra Dames, if we were going to piggyback on that somehow. But anyway, I'm aware of communications that are coming in. If there's something that I can further do to accommodate, please let me know, and I will do my very best. Community Administrator Livingston, do you have anything else to add at this point?
Nothing to add.
Very good. Again, on behalf of the committee, our committees, thank you so much for your great participation. Our committee is adjourned.